Sai's Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned. Om Shri Sai Ram. Loving salutations at the lotus feet of Bhagwan Shri Sathya Sai Baba, the voice, the ears, the heart and soul of Radio Sai, and also its executive producer, director and supreme manager. Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to Thursday Live. You're tuned to our Asia stream coming to you live from Prashanti Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. My name is Karuna and I will be hosting the segment called Morning Glory. Thank you so much for staying with us on this lovely Thursday morning, which happens to be April the 30th, 2015. And we are coming to you live from the Radio Sai studios in Prashanti Nilayam, where the time right now is 49 minutes past 9 a.m. Indian Standard Time. And I do realize that we are logging in 10 minutes too late than scheduled, but this is due to some in-house issues we are having, and I apologize for the same. Current weather conditions in Prashanti Nilayam call for clear skies with occasional cloud cover, but no sight of precipitation really, not yet at least. A daily high of a balmy 39 degrees Celsius with somewhat cooler evenings and overnight temperatures at 25 degrees Celsius. Yesterday was a fairly hot day here, but thankfully a thunderstorm in the evening cooled the temperatures and made it breezy and pleasant overnight. Coming up on Morning Glory today, a tribute to the apostle of compassion, Gautam the Buddha. Buddha Purnima, as you know, falls on May the 3rd, 2015 this year. And this is a day of great significance as it commemorates the birth, the enlightenment and the passing on of Gautam Buddha in the Theravada or the southern tradition. Throughout on Morning Glory today, we will revisit Bhagwan Baba's words about Lord Buddha, about Lord Buddha's glory and his teachings that we can all benefit from. Apart from gentle reminders from Buddha, I am also very pleased to bring you a very special Triswit Divinity interview. This truly is a Radio Sai exclusive, and this is a conversation with Mr. S. Gurumurthy, and I promise you it's going to be very engaging. But before I play it for you, let us hear what Bhagwan Baba said about Lord Buddha. Bhagwan Baba said, and I quote him, "Although all avatars or divine advents have been preaching only good things, people today are content to observe their birthdays without following their teachings." Buddha did not attach any importance to yajnas and yagas or other religious rituals. The reason is that he felt it was more important to ensure that the five sense organs were pure to begin with. Buddha sought to find out why the mind gets disturbed. He could not bear to see anyone suffer. Because Buddha did not interest himself in the study of the Vedas or in the performance of yagas and yajnas, he was dubbed an atheist. This is utterly wrong. Buddha was a pure-hearted person. From his childhood, Buddha could not bear the sight of anyone in pain. He was saddened at the sight of the old ill-treating the young, of men in authority harassing the people and the big fish swallowing the small ones. He realized that it was wrong for anyone to cause harm to others. Hence he declared, "Ahimsa Paramo Dharma, non-hurting is the supreme dharma." No one should cause hurt to others by speech, action or in any other way. According to him, true dharma or righteousness consists in refraining from causing harm to anyone in thought, word or deed. Truth is God. Buddha taught that people should adhere to truth and uphold it. I beg your pardon, and uphold it. Among Buddha's teachings, the foremost were Satya or truth and Dharma or righteousness. These are the teachings of the Vedas. Satyam Vada Dharmam Chara. Speak the truth. Practice righteousness. Bhagwan Baba goes on to say, Buddha felt that nothing was truly lasting. Parents were subjecting their children to various kinds of bonds and making their lives miserable. As soon as the children come of age, the parents are keen to get them married. They do not know what kind of happiness the child can get from married life. What happiness have the parents derived from their own married life, physically, mentally, or otherwise? No person, however intelligent, thinks about this matter. Even eminent scholars do not care to examine whether it is worthwhile pursuing sensuous pleasures instead of seeking that which is beyond the senses. Buddha felt intensely unhappy with his parents and others who combined to commit him to the bondage of a married life. One day at midnight, Buddha left the palace, giving up his wife and young son, Rahul. He abandoned everything out of the conviction, there is no mother or father, no kinsman or friend, no home or wealth. Awaken yourself. Buddha resolved to find out something which transcends all worldly relationships and pleasures. Buddha asked himself, what is this life? Birth is misery. Old age is misery. Wife is the cause of sorrow. There is misery at the end of life. Therefore, be alert and awake. Happiness is not to be found in any of the things of this world. Everything is fleeting. Man is wasting his life in the pursuit of the petty and temporary pleasures. Nirvana is the only truth. It is the sense of oneness with all life. To turn the mind towards that which is permanent alone is Nirvana. Unquote. Those were the divine words of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba about Lord Gautam Buddha, whose birth anniversary and the anniversary of his enlightenment and finally passing on falls on Buddha Purnima, which is on 3rd of May this year. With that divine reflections, dear sisters and brothers, it is time for me to play a Radio Sai exclusive Triswit Divinity interview conducted by my colleague, Mr. Bishu Prushti. Under the spotlight today is an eminent Indian, Mr. S. Gurumurthy, and I promise you, you're going to love this interview. So please have a listen.
Sai Ram, and a warm welcome to you, Mr. Gurumurthy, to the studios of Radio Sai. It's an absolute honor having you, someone who's a colossus of knowledge. And
thank you so much.
I'm really waiting to hear from you, especially all of us in the studio, to document your impressions about Indian culture and our sacred heritage, and what is it that we should value, what is it that we should focus our attention on for the India that Bhagwan wanted. Bhagwan always said that India is going to shine. So what is it that the current generation should be imbibing and should be looking at? But before we go on to that, I cannot resist asking you to reflect on your moments with Bhagwan, the times that you have had the chance to see Swami, interact with Swami, and the impressions that are etched in your heart.
See, actually my desire to see Bhagwan was because of an accident of someone forcing me that you should do it. Of course, I always had respect for all saints and seers, because I always believed that they certainly knew more than we ordinary people. I had really no opportunity to see him, but he is also not one of those persons who you could go and see just like that. And you can go and see him, but you can't really have a darshan or meet him.
Yeah, interaction is ultimately always left
impossible. So I had really no occasion to think of somehow making an effort to see him. One person from America, he rang me up once and told me that there is extraordinary amount of aircraft, fighter aircraft losses in the Indian Navy, unprecedented in the Indian Air Force, unprecedented in the history of Air Force. We were losing fighter aircraft almost every month, and more than a dozen aircrafts had been lost like that in a period of about 18 months or so. So he told me that the Pakistan and ISI are doing black magic on the Indian Air Force, and that is affecting our entire system. And he had done some extensive study of paranormal working and influencing of the mind. I have tons and tons of material. I know about it. It's a truth, and many of these rationalists and scientific thinkers will not accept it, but it's a fact, and you believe me, and the only person who can stop it is Swami, and you have to go and meet him. I said, I have no means of meeting him. You see, you call yourself a nationalist, and so many aircrafts are being lost, and you are doing nothing. And he will call me every 3 days, 4 days. It kept on nearly for 3-4 months. I said, Baba, don't harass me. I have no way by which I can accomplish this. Then one day, it must be 2003. I don't know exactly which month it was. So I asked Mr. Venu Srinivasan, who I knew was very attached to Baba. I asked him, Venu, I have this man is harassing my life out. Why don't you help me? He said, Guru, I can certainly take you to, at the time, I think it was Bangalore, that place.
Vrindavan Ashram, Whitefield.
Whitefield. Swami is there. I will take you. 3 days you keep. Morning we will go there. We will sit. And if you are destined to meet Bhagwan, you should. You will meet. I told him, we will meet. But third day you must tell Bhagwan that I have come for this purpose, because I have no personal interest.
Yes.
It is something which is a national interest, and somebody is driving me really into it. So first day we came and sat, morning 4 o'clock, 4:30. Swami came, he just passed. So I looked at Venu in despondence. Venu, sometimes you should try tomorrow. You should not. If tomorrow also he goes like that, day after also he goes like that, more than my 3 days, the fellow will harass me. So second day, I don't know what happened, Venu suddenly got up and told Swami, my friend has come with some big problem relating to the country and Swami must see you.
Okay.
Swami said, you come inside.
Wow.
So that was the first experience of face-to-face with Swami, and there were about 7, 8, 10 people. Some people had come from Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia and things like that. And I was there, and at least about 12-15 people were there. Then Swami materialized one gold chain and gave it to a woman, and he materialized another gold chain and gave it to somebody. And then ahead of me was my side of me was a very hefty man, and he materialized one ring and gave it to him. I said, how does he get a ring that fits this big finger? Afterwards, there was another, a very lean man, and he materialized one ring and gave it to him. How does this fit in? Then he called me, and then he materialized this.
Oh, this my very first was that he materialized.
Yes.
This ring. This was in which year?
2003.
Okay.
I don't exactly remember which period it was. I remember 2003 because by 2004 I have shifted to my new house. It was in my old house where the Indian who was in America came and met me. That is why I remember the
year.
Otherwise I would have forgotten the year also. So Swami put it, and then he looked at me. He said, the size is okay.
Oh my God.
Maybe he is observing me, and that is why he is able to guess that this is in my thought. Maybe he was reading my thought. And then I told Swami, I have to tell you something in private. Then there was an ante room.
Yes.
And he took me to that room. Venu also came. I told him about all this. Then Swami went into a deep contemplation about 4-5 minutes.
Okay.
Then he told me, tell your friend that you have told me and let him forget about it.
Okay.
I said, okay. Then after passing for a few seconds, he said, I will give him a prasadam, you go and give it to him. And he gave a prasadam, which was a diamond ring. It's a very large ring. I have not seen that man. Who? This American fellow.
Yes.
Who used to call me. I had never seen him.
Oh, you only known through the phone call?
Yeah. So the it would be like my index finger kind of very large ring. Then I went back that evening. The gentleman called me. I told him all that happened. I said, Baba has given you a ring. Then within the next 72 hours, he was a tall 6-footer, hefty man. This ring exactly fitted him.
Wow.
So I thought, you know, this is something beyond our... I am not judging Baba by this. See, these are all things which is beyond a dimensional approach. This is a dimensionless phenomenon. See, God is something beyond the grasp of ordinary people because we can only see in dimensions.
Correct.
This is a dimensionless phenomenon. So I thought, we just think that it is beyond our comprehension. That's how my mind related to those incidents. And that fellow then reported to me afterwards that these accidents did reduce. That was, even I was not noticing it. That is how the first episode ended. Of course, afterwards I had with other people, I had met Baba. But one of the most important experiences was when I came with a very important leader. I was the interlocutor between him and Swami. And Swami held my hand almost for 45 minutes when I was doing. He held my hand, and that was a great experience. And he never left my hand also.
Yes, something which confirmed in you that he is something beyond the world.
Obviously. You see, I mean, how each person will experience, you know, it depends on the depth of the relationship, understanding, meeting. But I certainly felt that this is a phenomenon.
And probably that propelled you to come back to this place whenever there was an opportunity.
You see, I wouldn't say I came on my own. I always felt that there was an occasion to come. Somebody was calling, somebody was going, like that. That's how I maintained some kind of a relationship. And of course, when after Swami attained Samadhi, when there was some problem, media was creating a lot of confusion. That was the time when Mr. V. Srinivasan asked me for my advice on how to handle the media. Then, for the first time, I studied the service activities. I knew service activities were going on, but I didn't know the extent of the services and the massiveness of the work and the adverse situation in which these activities were carried out and the time within which these were carried out. I mean, these are all not ordinary things. Then I studied and wrote in great detail, and then I found what kind of people he has attracted. 600,000 people, and I said I wanted the statistics of all the 600,000 people. They could provide only for 91,000 people. and I wrote how many are doctors, how many are lawyers, how many are executives, how many are businessmen, how many are judges, lawyers, journalists.
You're talking about the volunteers who have been
volunteers.
Part of the organization.
And at that time, I remember one of the very top officials' wife, she had been asking me, once she knew that I had some association, she said, I have registered for the past 5 years, I had no occasion to, please recommend my name so that I can do service. See, this is not possible without a very, very powerful spiritual pull.
Yes.
So, then I put all this in this article. See, the kind of people he has attracted, that's not possible without a very deep and a very powerful inner pull. Then I explained about the waterworks in Rayalaseema, Chennai, and medical and educational services, and asked the media, have you written one line about these things that you are writing about all muck? And I called them the Neo Mayos.
Yes.
Catherine Spectres.
Catherine Mayo.
So I thought maybe I couldn't give back anything when Swami was here. Maybe this is one way of my contributing to his mission. That's what I thought after writing the article.
But during this time, when you had the chance to really look at all the service projects in much greater detail, what were the revelations that came to you? What is it that you found are really unique to Satya Sai Seva organization, to the Satya Sai Central Trust and all the various missions of Bhagwan? Because you are someone who has seen so much of the country, you have seen so much of other social work which is going on in India and elsewhere. So what do you think are the features that really make these missions stand out, if they stand out?
See, the sheer massiveness of the work. See, you can run a college, you can run 50 colleges, that's no issue. But these waterworks, laying 2,000 kilometers of pipeline and 1,500 cisterns and 120 reservoirs, you know, these are all to conceive, you know, by their nature, it is a government's job.
Yeah, that's what the Chief Minister said, Chandrababu Naidu said.
It's a government's job.
Yes.
Because the sheer massiveness of the organization that you need to do this.
Yes.
And to say that within 18 months you would do it and complete it, and I mean, this is something not easy to understand. So these are all the things which made me believe that, you know, this, we go by ordinary per charts and all that, and this is some other chart which is working. And I also knew, I don't think he ever appealed for donations.
Never.
And on the other hand, the donors had waited for months.
Yes.
At least in one case I knew, one of my friends, he waited for months to give a donation of 125 crores. Swami didn't take it.
Oh yes.
He was so distraught that why is Swami not taking the money? See, this I have not heard anywhere. See, you may not ask for money, but when the money comes, you make the donor wait. So this I have not heard anywhere. These are all the impressions I got.
Even now, you tell doctors in India that, you know, there is a hospital which is providing high quality care, tertiary care, and it is being given free of cost. People don't believe. When it is not happening in India, you can imagine in the West, because Dr. Jeevanandam, who is one of the pioneers in heart transplantation surgery, he comes here often to do service in the hospital every year. He says that's how he spends his vacation. And he says that, you know, he has a picture of Swami's hospital in his office. And whenever people come, they ask him about it, he tells them, but no one believes.
There are no free lunches there.
It is sad that even though there is so much good happening, the people somehow feel that this just cannot happen, and the media never takes notice.
It's true, but it also means that we have also not attempted to take the media to the hospital.
Yes.
See, today, I am not saying that the media should not do it. The media is more concerned with small things in which the people are interested. Some murder take place, some theft take place, some gossip. Some great work is taking place somewhere. To write that, the media has no taste or inclination. It thinks the people are not interested in it. And you have also not got the skill and the capacity to write about positive things in a readable manner.
Correct.
So you run it like a documentary. So some training input also is required for the media. For example, sheer from management perspective, how this was done. It's worth a research. It could have been a PhD subject for a university. We could have gone and asked some university to do a PhD study of how this was done by a voluntary organization. What kind of commitment would have gone into it? Leadership, organizing skill, commitment, financing. You know, it's worth studying.
Yes.
But even we don't do that. See, you must understand, when it's not that you want to advertise the service, you want to make the people get interested in
correct.
The idea of service.
Yes.
The excellence.
Yes.
You know, you think only competition can provide excellence. There is absolutely no competition here. Only competition can promote excellence. Competition can make things cheap. Competition can only make things efficient.
Inspiration.
Here, nothing is there. In fact, complete absence of competition has produced a completely efficient and timely and quality product of a scale which even a corporate will shudder to think of taking up and executing. See, this is worth study. And I think there, in terms of sheer communication model, even we have not been a success. I would suggest it that these are things which must be very deeply studied.
Yes.
And then proper research is brought about. And you know, many of the people who work for it are fortunately alive. If somebody undertakes a study, it can be done. After another 5 years, maybe many of them will not be there.
Correct.
I would request the Satya Sai organization to initiate a proper doctoral study on the different service projects. How the modern economic theory or modern world view that only intense competition can produce efficient products is wrong. Intense devotion can
yes.
also do it.
Yes.
You know, this is an alternative model.
Wow.
So, I would suggest this kind of study.
Yes. Recently, one of the students, very meritorious students from Cambridge University, they wanted to study this. So, they sent one of their best students to be an intern and study the mobile hospital. In fact, recently it got the award, the CNN, CNBC TV18 award for innovation in healthcare.
I think you must have improved to some doctoral study of all the projects put together. And maybe some Cambridge or Oxford University or somebody can study it. You know, it is in the larger, voluntarism is in the blood, in the DNA of Indian culture. But it is not organized voluntarism. In the West, everything is organized. In our culture, nothing is organized. But everything happens in an organized manner. For example, take how these massive temples were constructed. Unbelievable amount of planning, engineering, architecture. To repeat one of these temples is just impossible. what is it that made it possible on which there has been absolute, there has been no slavery in this country. Every big construction in Roman culture, Greek culture, would have been accomplished by thousands and thousands of slaves. Forced labor. In the Indian history, nothing. In our culture, it is devotion. It's commitment. It's inspiration. It is the ambition to do that. That's what accomplished many of these things. So it is there. That you require proper motivation and inspiration for the people to be aroused for that high voltage voluntarism has been proved in this case. So, all that we need to do is to give an organized scope for them in the modern conditions. Otherwise it was happening. You take anything for instance. Care of elders, unemployed people, infirm people. It's completely organized at the family level. Otherwise the state has to organize it. It's a massive organization. Insurance companies, medical companies, hospitals provide health care.
Absolutely.
But here, families take care. You see in hospitals how many people go and attend on their relatives. And we are a relation-based society. It is this relation basis which makes this society functional as well as anarchic. What is the problem in hospitals in India? If somebody is ill, 50 people will go and see him. That is the problem in the hospital. But these 50 people taking care of it is the most important asset. Otherwise, nobody will take care of that person. You take railway station or bus stand or airport, if there are 100 travelers going, there will be 1,000 people seeing them off. You will not see it in any other country. Because it is a relation-based country. And that's why parents are being taken care of, infirm people are taken care of, unemployed people are taken care of. 8 crore unemployed people in India. Who feeds them? Relations. Father, near and dear, parents, family system. There is nothing, in the West all this has collapsed. So what has happened? Even husband and wife are not living together. You wanted to talk about Indian culture. 41% of the babies born in America are born for unwed mothers. It is 48% in England. 51% of the families do not have father and the mother living together. Single parent families. 55% of the first marriages end in divorce. 67% of the second marriages end in divorce. 73% of the third marriages end in divorce, according to the Psychology Today magazine. With the result, families have collapsed. Family functions have been taken over by the state. Care of elders, infirm, unemployed people. So families have been nationalized. Government is being privatized.
Families are nationalized and government is privatized.
Our entire economic, socio-economic, cultural model,
yes,
has actually unburdened the government. In US, the present value of future social and health security, the present value of future,
yes,
social and health security burden is $104 trillion.
My God.
The American GDP is only $16 trillion. Let us assume if all earning Indians decide to live only for themselves and not for their parents or elders or infirm people and unemployed people are to be taken care of by the state. Will there be any government in this country? So, when you talk about Indian culture, you don't only talk about values. You see what those values produce in economic terms,
yes,
in
terms.
Social terms,
yes.
Respect for parents, elders, respect for neighbors, fear of the society, shyness, you know, all this contributes to policing in this country. We have 668,000 villages and towns. Guess how many police stations we have? We have 12,800 police stations today for 668,000 villages and towns. You know, you go to the nationmuster.com. India has the lowest recorded crimes in the world. Theft, burglary, murder. These are not crimes which can go unrecorded. People can say rape can go unrecorded. Burglary cannot go unrecorded. Murder cannot go unrecorded. Theft cannot go unrecorded. In all this, the lowest rated crimes in the countries with the lowest crime rate in the world, India is among the lowest countries, the lowest crime rated countries in the world, with the least policing. Then what contributes to low crime rates in India? You know, the rape to population ratio in England is 80 times India's. 80 times. We know nothing about this country.
Yeah, we get very disillusioned with what we read in the newspapers.
Because in India it makes news. There it doesn't make any news. I tell you, one lady by name M.R. O'Toole, she wrote an article on the 10th of January 2013 about the Delhi rape. And many people lambasted India as a country of rapists and killers because of the Delhi rape. She said, you are talking about that country. One woman being ravaged, the entire country came to a halt for 1 month. That is the respect they have for women. In the West, it does not make news at all. Then she gave an example of a rape in Steubenville in America, where in September 2012, 3 months before the Delhi rape, a 16-year-old girl was taken from party to party and was butchered and thrown on the road. The police would not register a case. No newspaper would carry the news. A blogger wrote and there was a libel suit on him. After the Delhi rape case became big, they registered a case in January, arrested the accused in March. She said, what are you doing? She only said, the rape to population ratio in England as compared to Delhi is 4 times. If you take the whole of India, it is 80 times. In India, because there is respect for women, in the West they have rights. Rights and respects are two different paradigms.
Yes.
So in our culture, we emphasized more on duties than on rights. That is why elders are being taken care of, unemployed people are being taken care of, infirm people are being taken care of, mentally ill people are maintained at home. Otherwise, do you mean to say mentally ill patients in India can be maintained in asylum and hospital? You know what kind of hospital capacity you need, will need for that? This is relation-based society and that is a contract-based society.
But unfortunately, today's youth are so much, perhaps I may be wrong, but they are so much taken in by the Western way of progress, Western way of development. And you feel that if we stick on to our own values, then probably that is the reason why we have not progressed. See
but
how the
have
West
we ever told them our values produce economic results?
I think that is something that has
have
to be...
Have we ever told them? Because
yes.
We think these are good virtues. They are not just good virtues. They produce good economy.
Yes.
Good economic results are produced. That's why our savings rate is high.
Yes.
Why our savings to GDP ratio is 33-34%. It is only because we have relationship, we have responsibility, which translates into propensity for save, propensity to save, and because of the propensity to save at the micro level, macro level, there is higher national savings that results in higher national investment, that results in higher GDP. Have we ever linked it that way? Why in America the family savings used to be 80% of the national savings in 1960 and it has become minus 20% in 2006 third quarter? It is only because families have collapsed and there is no family responsibility, because family responsibilities have been taken over by the state, and so there is no responsibility for anyone to discharge, and so everyone is living happily, borrowing money and spending. And 30 crore Americans have 120 crore credit cards on which they owe $3 trillion debt. Their house is in debt. And it is the American family debts which they could not repay that created crisis in America.
Yes.
That transformed into a global crisis. So, when you talk about Indian culture, every value that the Indian culture has generated has resulted in economic output. Unless you link the two, they will think, you know, this is much better to be left. For example, take for instance, I addressed 35 groups, very highly professionally educated, very highly placed women, between August and December, August and January in Chennai, 35 groups, 1500 ladies I personally addressed. And I told them the paradigm difference between India and the West, how we respect women. How many of us know in the West women were never respected? In fact, they were never accepted as human beings till the 7th century. And even today, in Vatican, women priests do not have voting rights. It is religious. But it became a political value also. England practiced democracy for several hundred years. When did British women get voting rights? 1924. America practiced democracy from the beginning of the 18th century, 19th century. When did American women get voting rights? 1924. Britain 1926. Italy 1945, France 1945. You know when did Swiss women get voting rights? 1972. Till then they didn't get voting rights. Because women were not only not equal to men, they were not human beings. That's why thousands of women were burnt at stakes. But in India it is the reverse. When I had gone to America in 2001, I took the pictures of Durga Lakshmi and Saraswati. My friends asked me why. I said, because I was to have a private meeting with many white women. I said, I want to show what impact it makes. You know, I showed to them, most of them were white women. I showed them these three gods and said, this is the goddess of learning, this is the goddess of wealth, this is the goddess of power. Goddess? They could not imagine God in woman form. I said our God can be man, our God can be woman, our God can be man and woman, our God can be beyond all.
Yes.
And then I told them, it is not only that our God can be woman, our woman can be gods. Then I explained to them the concept of Kanya Puja, Suhasini Puja. Many of them wiped out their tears and said, we have no respect. Because they don't have respect. Have we ever told Indian women this? When I told this to Indian women, that it is the freedom over body which is called modernity, and your value is in terms of 50 kgs of flesh and 30 years of life, there is nothing beyond it. There is the respect. Many of them were shaken. Mr. Gurumurthy, it's mind-boggling. Then we held Swami Vivekananda Women's Convention on the 23rd of January, on the birth anniversary of Swami Vivekananda. 1,200 women attended. For the first time we said, modernity, which is based on rights, which is bereft of duties, which is based on assertive womanhood and not respectful womanhood is a danger to India. This is a declaration they made. But where is the intellectual articulation? Spiritualists don't do it. Intellectuals don't do it. Media doesn't do it. English educated persons do not go into the depth of the Indian culture, its traditions, its values, family system. Then how do you think the youngsters are going to think differently? It is the elder generation which has failed the country.
We have not been able to communicate all these traditions which have come to us.
Take for instance respect for nature. You know, in 1967, Lynn White wrote a seminal article in the Science magazine that it is because of Christianity that environment collapsed in the world. You know why? Because the world is considered to be secular. There is no sacredness in the world. It is the other world which is sick. That is why sacred-secular distinction is not inherent to our culture. Everything is sacred here.
Okay, every tree is God.
There is nothing secular. The body is sacred.
Yes.
This chair is sacred. This any object is sacred. That is why every instrument is worshipped.
Yes. Vishwakarma puja. And
everything. Because in everything we see God.
Yes.
So in nature, in trees, in rivers, you know, there is a sloka in Virat Parva. It says, tigers cannot exist without forests. Forests cannot exist without tigers. Tigers protect forests. Forests protect tigers. Apply it to the empirical data available. In the year 1900, we had 40,000 tigers and 41% forest coverage. Today we have 1,800 tigers and 19% forest coverage. Your forest protection law will never protect forests. Only tigers will protect forests. Only wildlife will protect forests. Now you want tigers, for which forest is needed. You can't create forests and you can't create tigers at the same time. How great our ancients must have been. So Lynn White said, it is because the monotheistic faith said that God created the world for the enjoyment of man. Man devastated nature. 30% of the rainforests were destroyed in a matter of 300 years. An uproar. And then at least few hundred books came saying it is true. You know, there are 1,000-year-old trees which communities worshipped as God. They were failed to show there is no God in Africa. So, the United Nations is now asking all religions. In 2010, the IIT Bombay had invited me for a lecture called Avenues Program, and ahead of me one great industrialist spoke, and he said that we were a great country in culture, civilization, spirituality, everything, but we were very poor in economics, and we knew about prosperity only when globalization was there. And before that, we had only what is known as Hindu rate of growth. And the entire IIT students, research scholars, professors stood up and clapped. I was to speak next, but I knew it was completely false. So I said what my previous speaker spoke was true in 1978, not afterwards. They didn't know this. Then I said in 1978 this happened. First in 1853, Karl Marx wrote a couple of articles in New York Herald Tribune saying in the Indian society, every village is an independent economic unit and there was no exploitation. But at the same time, the society is a backward society. It is worshipping monkeys and cows. And so the British are doing the right thing by destroying its society and economy to prepare this country for revolution. Otherwise, this country is changeless for the last 2,000 years. This was his objection about India. The man never came to India. He never met any Indian. He never read any Indian literature. But he pronounced on India and he became the most influential thinker in the Indian academia, intellectuals and the media. Then Max Weber, he wrote a thesis that Protestant civilizations grow faster because of individualism, enterprise and entrepreneurship. Catholics do not. They are a backward society. And so modern capitalism will work only under Protestant Christian ethic. He was right so far as the Christian societies are concerned. But he suddenly wrote a book on the religion of Hinduism and Buddhism and said these two countries will never come up because they believe in karma and rebirth. These two persons completely influenced the Indian academia. And in 1945, Churchill said India will go into anarchy. Mahatma Gandhi said I will prefer anarchy rather than slavery. And in 1963, Galbraith, he came to India and he said it is a functioning anarchy. And we began quoting. Galbraith says we are a functioning anarchy, as if it is a compliment to us. And then in 1978, Professor Raj Krishna, who had been economic advisor and all that, he was asked a question by the media, we are following the same socialist policies. Why is it that we are growing slowly? He said, what can we do? We can have only Hindu rate of growth. That is where the Hindu rate of growth idea came. The next 3-4 years, Robert McNamara addressed at least half a dozen conferences all over the world. Here is one country which will never grow. We need aid for this country. This will only survive one aid from outside. It cannot stand on its own leg. Because its own economist has said it will only achieve low rate of growth. This was the position in 1978. In 1983, a stunning development takes place in the West. One Paul Bayrock, a Belgian economist, studied the world economy between 1750 and 1900 and came out with his finding. In 1750, China had 34.5% of world GDP, India 24.5%, and England and America put together only 2%. And the whole thing changed in 1900. China and India crashed to 8%, India 1.8% and China 6.2%. England and America went to 41%. The West was shaken. That means in 1700, India had a much better standard of living than America and England. They couldn't tolerate it. So the OECD countries constituted a study. And Angus Madison, the greatest economic historian, was asked to undertake a study. 2000 years of economic history was studied. First year of the common era, India was the number one country. 10th century, India was leading. 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, India was the leading economic power. 15th, India and China equal. 16th, China overtakes India. 17th, India overtakes China. 1900, they were overtaken by others. When I mentioned this to the IIT students and said, actually the Hindu rate of growth had actually put India ahead of all other countries. It is the colonial and socialist rate of growth which crashed us. The entire IIT, the audience came and surrounded me and said, sir, we don't see any use for these buildings which does not teach us these things. And they told me, don't stop with this. We want you to start a course for us. You know, for the last 3 years, I'm running a course in IIT Bombay.
Wow, fantastic.
One semester I'm taking, it's a 50-mark subject for MBA students.
And that is really heartening that the...
You have kept this youth so ignorant of your history, tradition, culture, economic achievements. And why do you blame them? They have no confidence. You have said it's a return of civilization, it's a backward civilization, it's a barbaric civilization, it's an anarchy, it's a functioning anarchy. It worships monkey and cows. And you expect these students to, each one of them to do independent research and come up and say this, what is being taught in the classroom is not correct? We have kept our people ignorant. So, I have a feeling that unless very important people are going to take clear position and say that throw all these books, but now everything is available on internet. You don't need a textbook today.
Yes.
You know what Marco Polo has written in 13th century? The Indian ships were several times larger than the Greek ships. It required 300 people to run a ship. It was the ships were three decked and they were built to last for 100 years. you know, we had 40,000 ships when Akbar ruled India, 34,000 ships when the British entered India. We had a million ton capacity, and when the British left, our ships had come down to 1,200, and our carrying capacity was only 100,000 tons. And the British passed orders that Indian carpenters, if they build ships, they will be arrested and fined. And the entire shipbuilding industry came to a halt in India. So, I think when we talk about our culture, we should not talk about only finer values. These finer values have a certain life model.
Yes.
And that life model produces a certain types of economics. And that is far more durable than the market kind of economics. You know, this intellectual orientation needs to be given to our people. Otherwise, the study of our culture will be incomplete. Why should you respect the father? This is the question. Why should you respect your teacher? In America, in 2009, they conducted a study how 4% Asians are finding 35% admission in Harvard, Stanford and Carnegie Mellon. And the study showed it is not because the Indian students are smarter than the American students, these Asian students. They said in two lines, they respect the students, teachers in class and parents at home. This is the study.
Fantastic.
Then you say respecting teachers is a personal respect you are showing to an elderly person. You are showing respect for the process of learning.
Yes.
Once you combine these two, respect for a teacher produces this effect. Then respect for a teacher will have a different meaning. Respect for parents produces privatized social security. And so the government is unburdened. So then the economy will improve. Then the way you will look at respect for parents will be different.
When you were mentioning about the India story, for all the centuries, we had such fantastic amount of GDP. We are one of the richest countries, and then everything collapsed sometime during the 1900s. One thing is colonization, but do you feel that there was, in some way, there was some deterioration in the moral fiber of the country?
No. It is the war model of India which was responsible for it. It has been now proved. The Indian war model, which was the noblest in the world, which distinguished between combatants and non-combatants, which was prevalent till the 16th and 17th centuries in Kerala. Whatever you saw in heard in Mahabharata, that the two sides used to have a cup of tea in the evening and they used to chit-chat, in the morning they used to clash. Precisely the same thing happened in Kerala when the Portuguese were stunned. They will not fight in the night. You should never take the enemy by surprise.
Yes.
And both sides used to sit together and have coffee, used to have the bath in the same place, change their dress. At the beat of the drum, they will move over and form and then begin clashing. He said, what is this? It's an artificial rule. But this is a noble rule. This was the reason for India losing its independence. Value systems were lost because you lost your independence. This has been studied by many Indologists. Waitavai was the person who wrote the Kerala war model. And Madhav Menon, in the history of Kerala, he has quoted all these instances. So whatever was there in Mahabharata was actually practiced in Kerala. That means it has been practiced everywhere.
But this worked to our disadvantage.
Absolutely. Because if you don't consider the other person as your enemy, and all over the world war was barbaric. I want you to go through one website, Professor Ramal, Hawaii University. He has built a website on democide. You know, the number of killings that have taken place outside India is 1.4 billion in the last 2000 years. And the number of deaths in India till the 13th century, only in one case it exceeded 1 lakh, and that was Ashoka's war, Kalinga war. Only after the Muslim invasion there was 4.5 million deaths in this country. outside India, 1.4 billion. Did anyone inquire how 1/6 of humanity could live in this peace?
Exactly.
R.J. Ramal, you see that website. I would like you to put it out in your system of communication so that people come to know about all this.
Yes.
So I feel deterioration comes when you lose your independence. Then you lose your respect for yourself.
Confidence.
You lose respect for gods. You lose respect for your ancestors. And that is how you cease to be who you are. And then deterioration comes.
Today, there is a tendency that if you want to become successful, then you will have to perhaps compromise. You know, if you completely go by your character, then you probably will not get success in the way someone else gets through connections and through other means. Can spirituality value systems coexist with success, with a flourishing career? Do all of them come together? Or many people box spirituality and religion, and then they box their business and their career into different compartments. Do you think they come together?
Yes. You see, I'll tell you, it all depends upon what is respectable and not what is powerful. Even today, there is respect for honesty or not, tell me.
There is.
There is respect for truth or not, tell me.
There is respect, but people are people feeling encouraged enough to take the path?
Because you are not making people to long for respect. You make respectability respectable. Our education must be to make the people long to be respected and not long to be powerful. There are people in power. You call a governor, you don't respect him. You call a chief minister to your ashram, you don't respect him. You call him because he's there, he's powerful.
You respect the position.
Position. But that's why we tried a different experiment. We heard in the newspaper an auto rickshaw driver, somebody went into the railway station and he found 2 lakh rupees. He has left the bag. He straight went to the commissioner's office and handed over the bag. Came in the newspaper. Then we went and met him. He said, "Sir, many times I have returned. This time I returned to the true owner. This time I had to return to the policeman. And the amount was big. People had left their bag. I don't know what was in the bag. People had left their cell phones, people had left their transistor, everything I had returned because I knew where the owner was. This time the owner had gone into the train, so I gave it to the police official." We went to his house. Desperate conditions. The 2 lakh was very, very essential for him. And he needed a job for his daughter. And the house is hand-to-mouth existence. Then for the Independence Day of a school, we asked that man to come and hoist the national flag.
Wow.
There was not a child which did not cry on that day.
Amazing.
Why are you calling these crooks for this place? Why don't you call such people? You go into, you know how honest this country is? Have you heard of lost valid test? You go to Google. Lost wallet means you throw a purse with money in parks, in railway stations, in bus stands, with a visiting card of the owner. How many wallets come back? You know what is the number of wallets which came back in India? 65%. Higher than Germany, higher than Japan, equal to England. It's there in Google. Ordinary people. There is one mobile telephone test, MTT. In Bombay, out of 30 telephones which were thrown on the road, 25 got returned. Same as New York. You call this country dishonest? It is the educated man, English educated man is more dishonest than the ordinary people of India. This man knows how to rationalize things. Because he speaks in English, he is accepted as an intellectual. you see how many auto rickshaw people, taxi drivers have written. Bombay taxi drivers are known to be more honest than any other city in the world. We must celebrate them. Then you will know what is respectable. Your children, your media, your people will know what is respectable. For example, in this ashram, you come and present one such auto man as the true inheritor of the teachings of Baba. He may not have even seen Baba, but he has inherited the teachings.
Yes.
Then see the dimensional change. What we project is what we will get.
Yes.
We are not projecting the right people.
The media is not being, but all of us, we have to.
We should do it. That's why we experimented it, no? We brought that auto driver. He could not speak one word. We spoke for him. We introduced him.
That is the way change will come.
Change will come provided we know how to bring about changes. By talking about changes, changes will not come.
Finally,
thank you.
What is the idea of India that you want to be passed on to the current generation?
See, the idea of India that I want to be passed on is an India which they are aware. They are not aware of that India. Take for instance Tamil Nadu. In 1967 in Tamil Nadu, gods were sent out completely. Everybody thought it was, oh, none of us could wear anything on our forehead and walk on the road. Murli must be knowing it. Today it is the most devout state in the country. They are wearing the very black shirt by which they discredited and disrespect God. 1 crore people are going to Sabarimala today. It just happened in 30 years. So, India is basically a religious country. It is religion which is the backbone of India. This is what Swami Vivekananda said. We must teach the durability of India. We are not doing anything. So, some thinking somewhere will have to start. So I think this combination of the empirical India and the spiritual India, the alignment between them, how spiritual India has produced this empirical India.
It brought out economic development, social harmony, everything.
Yes. It has privatized social security.
Yes.
Not by any law or legislation of the government. It is by the idea of dharma.
Yes.
Have we ever passed on this truthful knowledge? I would like the young Indians to be made aware of the real India. You see, they do not know. They only know the cosmetic India, the filmy India, the theatrical India.
Thank Wonderful, you. Sir. Thank you very much for your time.
Sairam, dear listeners, you just heard that engaging Trist with Divinity conversation with an eminent Indian, Mr. S. Gurumurthy. He was in conversation with Radio Sai's Mr. Bishop Prushti. We look forward to your feedback by email at listener@radiosai.org. And now, as this is a Buddha Purnima special, let us reflect once again on Bhagwan Baba's divine words on Lord Buddha and Lord Buddha's message. Baba says, and I quote him, "Once Buddha entered a village along with his disciples. A lady requested him to have food in her house. Buddha blessed her and accepted her invitation. Seeing this, many villagers, including the village headman, warned Buddha, saying, 'O Buddha, you are one of wisdom and have renounced everything. She is not a woman of good character. It is not proper for you to have food in her house.' Buddha smiled and asked the village headman to come forward. Buddha held the right hand of the headman and asked him to clap. The headman said it was not possible for him to clap as one of his hands was in Buddha's hands. Then Buddha said, 'True. Is it possible to clap only when two hands come together, is it not? Likewise, this lady cannot turn bad by herself unless there are men of bad character in this village. The men of this village are the root cause of her bad character.' On hearing this, the villagers realized their folly, fell at Buddha's feet, and sought his forgiveness. Through his teachings, Buddha instilled sacredness and wisdom in people. Buddha's teachings are highly sacred with profound inner meaning. Baba goes on to say, in a life filled with desires, the pleasures one seeks are inevitably followed by grief and disappointments. All unrighteous actions lead to sorrow. It was for this reason that Buddha emphasized the need for discrimination. The first prayer, Buddham Sharanam Gacchami, is a call for cultivating wisdom and discrimination, the buddhi. But unless the power of discrimination is used for doing right action for the good of society, it is of no use. Hence the second prayer, Sangam Sharanam Gacchami. I surrender myself to society. What is this right action that must be done? That is indicated by the third prayer, Dharmam Sharanam Gacchami. I take refuge in Dharma. To reach your goal, the royal road is Dharma or righteousness. It is only when these three are combined, wisdom, social service and righteousness, that there is fulfillment in life. Unquote. Those were the divine words of Bhagwan Baba on the life and teachings of Lord Buddha, the apostle of compassion. Today, dear listeners, we are celebrating the glory of the great Master Buddha on Morning Glory because Buddha Purnima falls on May the 3rd this year and will be celebrated with much love and reverence in the true Buddhist tradition here in the ashram at Prashanthi Nilayam. And now it is almost time for me to close and I wish you a wonderful day ahead and I would like to leave you with a special musical offering from the creative musicians at Radio Sai who composed this special tune in honor of Lord Buddha and Buddha Purnima. Till we meet next week, please be well, take care and always be serene like the Buddha. And enjoy this musical offering. Till we meet next Thursday, Jai Sai Ram.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
The 90th year of Bhagwan Baba's divine advent is here. What are you planning to offer at his lotus feet? How about a gift wrapped in red? If you wish to partner with the Sai Healthcare to save a precious life, please take the time to donate blood at the Sri Satya Sai Super Specialty Hospital whenever you are visiting Puttaparthi. The blood bank is open Monday through Saturday, 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Every single day, patients undergo life-saving procedures here and a pint of blood can make all the difference. Let's build a favorable blood inventory. If you're a healthy adult, please donate. For more information, please visit psg.sssihms.org.in. blood, it's in you to give. Please donate. Sai Ram.